I'd like to discuss what's come to be called these days heterotic M theory. Heterotic M theory is a fundamental brain world universe that rises naturally out of M theory, or at least the 11-dimensional manifestation of M theory. I think the biggest problem I have in describing this theory is that it requires some mathematics of bundles, which is gets to be a little heavy at times. So I thought I would change gears here based on comments of some of my close colleagues and spend the first third of this lecture discussing some of the physical motivations that go behind the theory before launching into some more details. So the idea is based on the fundamental work of Horjava and Witten. Starting with 11-dimensional supergravity, one wants to compactify this on an orbifold, simply S1/Z2. You take a circle. If you mark a point 0, you'll have some point x and some point minus x. If you identify them under Z2, and you do that everywhere on the circle, that's S1/Z2. It's essentially a line interval that goes from 0 to pi rho. Now, what that will do is produce 11 dimensions in the bulk region in between, but on the boundaries, you'll have boundaries of space-time, which are 10-dimensional, one on one side, one on the other. These are the orbifold fixed planes. Now, the Z2 also has to act on the fields in the theory, and in particular, there's a gravitino in 11-dimensional supergravity, and Z2 acts as shown here between x and minus x. As long as you're in the bulk, it doesn't make too much difference. If you get a solution of the theory, it has to satisfy that criterion. But what it becomes interesting when you move to the orbifold fixed plane, when you move over to one side or the other, this is true on both sides, because at that point, x becomes equal to minus x becomes equal to, let's say, 0 on this side. And these two equations then simply become constraint equations on the gravitino, and they project out half of the degrees of freedom of the gravitino, and they produce chiral fermions. That was the idea of Horjava and Witten, precisely produce chiral fermions. If you do that, however, you have the classic problem that you will get anomalies. And in this case, the only field in town is gravity. So you end up getting gravitational anomalies on these bounding orbifold planes. However, given all the technology of string theory, particularly heterotic string theory over the years, they know how to cancel this anomaly. To begin with, on each orbifold plane, you have to put an n equals 1 E8 Yang-Mills supermultiplet, one on one side, one on the other. There's no room for SO32 in this theory precisely because it's split into two pieces. In between, you have this 11-dimensional bulk space. That's the orbifold cutting across it. But you have to do more than add the E8 supermultiplets on the boundaries. You also have to modify the Bianchi identity for the field strength of the 3-form in supergravity. So if G is that field strength, dG would normally be 0, but you end up putting Chern-Simons forms on the right-hand side. This is required in order for there to be a Green-Schwarz cancellation of the anomaly. So they worked out exactly what you had to do. In the bulk, you don't have to do anything, but on the boundaries where the E8s live, you have to add a source, one on one side, one on the other side. And the sources are fairly simple. It's trace F wedge F. It's the Chern class. But you have a half trace R wedge R. On one side, you'll have one E8. On the other side, you have the other E8. And there's all kinds of interesting stuff here involving this half and so on, but I don't have time here to discuss that. If you add that, you will then get a Green-Schwarz mechanism cancellation of that mixed gauge gravitational anomaly. Those gentlemen went on to do a lot of other stuff, including Ed compactified down to 4 dimensions directly and discussed a great deal of the physics. I want to take a slightly different tack here, which is to take that theory as just shown and compactify it directly on a Calabi-Yau manifold. So we're going to take this entire theory and just wrap it up on a 6-dimensional real space or a threefold, Calabi-Yau threefold. I never know how to draw these things, so that's my attempt. Of course, everywhere in here this is being wrapped up. I'll just show the wrapping on the orbifold planes. However, since that's a six-dimensional surface, real surface, then we end up with a bulk space now, which is five-dimensional. And there's a certain sense in which that's a prediction of these kinds of theories that one might really have physics going on in five-dimensional space. You can see the brain world emerging to some extent. Also, on each of the orbifold planes, what's left is a four-dimensional world, a three-plus-one-dimensional world. And what you have to ask now is, what is the gauge group that is left on each of these orbifold planes? It was originally E8 on either plane. Is it still E8? Well, that's where it gets interesting. That's also where the mathematics comes from. What happens is that, let's just look at one of these planes. You have an E8 living there, and you might imagine that there's a vacuum for that E8. Normally, you don't have vacuum expectation values for gauge fields because they break Lorentz invariants, but you don't care here because you've already broken six-dimensional part of the Lorentz invariants. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with having non-trivial gauge groups as long as they live on the Calabi-Yau and point in the Calabi-Yau direction. And they don't have to be the entire E8. You can pick some G subgroup out of the E8 and turn those on in the background, living on the Calabi-Yau. And these things will act as some kind of vacuum expectation value background. And I'll refer to them simply as G instantons. Now, it's not just any old instantons. They have to preserve n equals 1 supersymmetry, so they have to be solutions of the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations. And I'll discuss that in a minute, but you can do that. So what you will get then in this low-dimensional world in which we live is an n equals 1 supersymmetric gauge theory. However, the gauge group will not necessarily be E8. It'll be H, where H is the commutant of the instanton group G in E8. So I'll give you examples of what those are. Those can be interesting groups, in particular, interesting grand unified groups. So out of many possible examples, one could, for instance, these are subgroups that are embedded in E8. If we chose the structure group of the instanton of ESU3, the commutant group would be E6. That's along the lines of the standard embedding from the heterotic string, the weak coupled heterotic string. But you can do lots of other stuff. You can pick SU4, get an SO10 gauge theory. You can pick SU5, get an SU5 gauge theory, and so on. So that's a very nice mechanism. When you compactify like this, you can actually get reasonable grand unified groups living on these boundary brain walls that might be of phenomenological interest. Now, the point I want to emphasize is that, and this is where the mathematics all seems to come from, is that it's easier to say this than it is to do this in reality. And if one wants to be honest and serious here, you should actually show that these vacuums exist. Now, what you have to find, if you're thinking in terms of instantons, are you take some subgroup G of E8, and you have to find Yang-Mills solutions of the Hermitian-Yang-Mills field equations on a Calabi-Yau space. And as far as I know, that's completely unknown how to do that. It's hard enough to do it on a flat space. It is known how to construct them all on flat space, but that construction is also rather intricate. On Calabi-Yau space, it's just simply unknown what they are. So all progress would stop at this point if it weren't for some beautiful theorems by Donaldson and by Uhlenbeck and Yao, who showed the following thing. They said, well, let's consider the same Calabi-Yau space, but let us construct so-called holomorphic vector bundles of a particular type, semi-stable holomorphic vector bundles. Now, it turns out that you can make a lot of progress with constructing these bundles, as abstract as they may sound. Now, the point is that for every one such holomorphic vector bundle, there will be a solution of these Hermitian-Yang-Mills field equations and vice versa. So if you can construct the bundles, you're really constructing the instantons, even if it sounds hopelessly abstract to your colleagues. So so that's the attempt here. It's not to do mathematics, but the attempt is to actually construct the vacuum so that you know it exists and can work with it. This is possible. You might think that, in fact, you're trading one bad news for another bad news. But there's fundamental work here due to Ed Witten and Freeman and Morgan at Columbia, also Ron Donaghy, Tony Panta, Vershadsky, Sadoff, other people. I'm sure I'm leaving some out. These people have shown how to go a long way in constructing such bundles, and we've done some extension of it as well, as I'll discuss later on. So we can actually compute this, so we can compute these instantons, so we can actually give you real vacua with interesting gauge groups. These go beyond standard embeddings. They give you sort of arbitrary embeddings of the group, which give you a lot of flexibility to do physics. So that's what's going on the boundary. But you might ask what's going on inside the bulk. And what happens inside this five-dimensional bulk is that you get n equals 1 five-dimensional supersymmetry. If you like, n equals 2, if you think of it from the four-dimensional point of view. And it's got a fixed and well-defined number of fields. This bulk is not empty. It's active and alive. It's got five-dimensional supergravity, which is a graviton and a vector field, A. It's also got a universal hypermole split, including V, the breathing mode of the Calabi-Yau, plus other stuff. I'll call that Q in a minute. It's got a lot of other hypermultiplets, and it also has vector multiplets. And the number of hyper and vector multiplets depend on these Hodge numbers of whatever Calabi-Yau you happen to be using. So you can actually compute everything you wish to know about this. For instance, I can dimensionally reduce in the appropriate way and get the effective actions in the bulk and on the boundary. So I'll just give you a simplified version here. You can find the whole story in the literature. We'll just leave out all this other stuff and consider only universal multiplets. We find the following action. There's the usual five-dimensional supergravity action, nothing interesting. However, the universal hypermultiplet is very interesting. It turns out to couple to supergravity in a gauged way. So you have some specific gauging of these hypermultiplets when they couple to this supergravity. And I'll discuss this gauged covariance derivative in a second. But as often happens, when you gauge a supergravity theory, you end up getting an extra potential. And that's exactly what happens here. You get an exact potential energy for the breathing mode of the Calabi-Yau space, which comes out in this form. Because of that, you also induce a potential on the boundary, which also comes out in a very specific and exact form. If you look at Randall syndrome, for example, you'll see exactly these numbers appearing there. This is the kind of structure that you must get when you're coming down from 11-dimensional supergravity. So what does this gauging look like, and what does it do for you? Well, first of all, the gauge connection is simply the vector field inside the supergravity multiplet itself. It's a very specific gauging. It's in the axionic direction with a charge minus 4/3 and so on. You're told by 11-dimensional supergravity and anomaly cancellations exactly how you do this gauging. It's not free. There are other ways to gauge supergravity, but this is the way that you have to do to satisfy anomaly cancellation in the strong coupled heterotic string. So it's a specific gauging. What we noticed right away, this work was done with Kelly Stell, as well as Lucas and Waldron, by the way, this part of it. We noticed right away that this thing looked a lot like extended type 2A supergravity, which was a theory introduced by Larry Romans a long time ago. This Romans theory was important because it, and only it, allowed a classical construction of the BPS 8-brain solution in type 2A theories. So you could get the D minus 2 8-brain domain wall precisely because you had these extra cosmological terms in that theory. Well, we also had gauge supergravity, and we had these cosmological terms. So we asked, well, is it possible that we have D minus 2 3-brains in this theory? And the answer is almost trivially is yes. And you can compute them easily enough. So brains emerge naturally in this world as solutions of this theory. However, you can't just have one of them because of the orbifolding structure. The minimal vacuum has to have two of them, one three-brain against the orbifold plane on one side, three-brain against the orbifold plane on the other side. Here's your five-dimensional bulk, and this is an exact solution. This is anything but flat in the interior. It's got metric, and for instance, the first component of that metric, the a squared component, is just linear as you move across the bulk. That's the so-called warp factor in this case. No, that's the prefactor. It's not exponential. Now, if you fix the dilaton, you will get an exponential solution. So, in fact, the Randall-Sundrum case will arise from this with a fixed dilaton exactly because it's the same Lagrangian. But I'm letting the breathing modes relax. The breathing mode of the Calabi-Yau, yeah. A main point of this is that this theory really does not admit flat space as a solution. And this is something that Ed Witten actually showed in somewhat different form right very early when he compactified directly to four dimensions. He found what I don't know whether he called or we called a deformation of the Calabi-Yau space. There was a deforming property that had to go on to preserve n equals 1 supersymmetry in four dimensions. In this language, it's simply saying that if you look at the five-dimensional effective theory, that it contains BPS three brains as the fundamental ground state. To leading order in kappa squared, those three brains are exactly Ed's deformation of the Calabi-Yau. Now, that's the minimal vacuum. You can go beyond that, and you can have what we call non-perturbative vacuums simply because they contain extra solitons in them. You can have, in addition, any number of three brains that live in the bulk, let's say from 1 to capital N of them, that live in the bulk space. So this bulk space is an active thing. It's got brains in it. It also has hypermultiplets and vector multiplets. And then you have the world of gauge theories living on the edge. These internal brains have a clear interpretation from M theory. They can be oxidized back up, and you immediately realize that they're nothing but wrapped five brains, where in order to preserve n equals 1 supersymmetry, they're wrapped around a holomorphic curve in the Calabi-Yau space. If that curve has genus G, which it can well have, then you actually get a gauge theory appearing on the world volume here, which will be U1 to the G. And you can push these brains together, and a la Ed's work, you can get an enhancement like UN to the G and so on, but I don't have time to discuss that here. Now, it's nice to draw the picture, but you actually have to do some work here. Every time you introduce one of these brains, it's anomalous, just the way the boundaries were anomalous. And you have to use anomaly inflow and other technology to cancel that anomaly. And one thing you have to do again is add another source term on the right-hand side of the Bianchi identity. And the source term you have to add it at each point for each brain. You add a source term at that point. And if you ask what it is, it's the Poincaré dual of the homology class of the curve on which the five brain is wrapped. So there's going to be some two-dimensional, how do you say it? There's some homology class for that curve, and you can take its dual, and it'll be a four form. So that's what you put in there. That's the source. This is, if you like, the manifestation of anomaly cancellation. It's there precisely because you're really doing 11-dimensional supergravity. You're really doing Harava-Witten theory. You cannot ignore it. So if you really want to do the theory properly so it's anomaly-free, that's the way life is. If you integrate that thing over an arbitrary four-cycle, you discover a very fundamental theorem, which says simply that the second Chern class of the bundle on one side, let's say our observable world, plus the second Chern class of the vector bundle on the other side, which is, some, let's say, a hidden sector, plus W, which has to do with these extra five brains in the middle, is equal to the second Chern class of the tangent bundle of that space. These Chern classes are just trace F wedge F for the vector bundle and trace R wedge R for the tangent space. W is nothing but these classes that are representing the five brain. But W is very important, as you will see. You don't just put in brains the way you want. They actually are predicted, and you can exactly predict the class of those brains from which flows a lot of their properties. So So none of this is just put in a brain and do this or that. It's all tight, and you can solve for all of the properties. In addition, the third Chern class of the vector bundle, let's say the one we're interested in on the observable sector, is given by this formula. It gives you the number of generations if you divide by a half, given by that formula. Yes. So these are the fundamental formulas for M theory, and everything that follows requires a solution of these topological equations. It mixes everything together. It's really coming down in a very tight way from the anomaly cancellation properties of M theory and Hrabowitz theory, and also our instanton bundles, as you'll see. So there's two important issues, and that's what I want to discuss today in a little more mathematical form, but let me just tell you what they are first. First one is that, as I've shown you so far, let's take an example of SU5. If I take an SU5 structure group for a bundle, let's say on the observable wall, on the observable 3-brain, then I'm going to get an SU5 grand unified theory on our world, our 3+1 dimensional world. And I can even adjust the bundle so that I get 3 families when I do that. The fundamental problem is that we have to break SU5 down to the standard model gauge group, and it's not so easy to do that with the technology that I've shown you previously. But you can do it, and the way we know how to do it now is simply to look at Calabi-Yau spaces, and in particular here I'm interested in elliptic fibered Calabi-Yau spaces that have a hole in it. So if we're doing the SU5, what I'd like to get is a homotopy group of Z2 here so that I can wrap a Z2 Wilson line around that vacuum. If I can do that, and we can construct such things, and that's what I will show you in the second part of this talk, then in fact the SU5 grand unified theory in the observable world will be broken by that Wilson line down to the standard gauge group. So we'll still have 3 families. That will not upset the 3 families. So we get closer and closer to something that looks like the real world. You're in a 3+1 dimensional 3-brain living at the boundary of some 5 dimensional bulk. On that 3-brain, there's 3 families of quarks and leptons. They have the standard gauge group. There's a lot of other things that can happen here. I don't know what they mean. Time will tell. And I just have time today to discuss just one of them. There's a lot of new non-perturbative behavior that you hadn't seen before that has to do with the fact that you have a bulk space now, and inside that bulk space there are wrapped 5 brains. These things can move around and they can do stuff. One of the things you might ask yourself is, if you go inside the bulk, so there'll be the hidden sector brain over here, we take, let's say, all the 5 brains, and we move them to the wall, what would happen, for example? I mean, one could imagine that happening in real time with real dynamics. So we start off with some vector bundle, we'll call it Z1, with some structure group G1. Its commutant is H1, so that will be the grand unified group here. And we will set it up so there's, let's say, M families. As I'll show you later, that will, in general, require that there be non-vanishing W here, meaning that there must be 5 brains. Now let's push them against the wall and see what happens. The claim is, and I will show you that this is in fact true, the claim is that you can go through a singular vector bundle called a sheaf, a torsion-free sheaf, which is something introduced by Ed a few years ago called a small instanton. When this touches the wall and you move in moduli space, you will proceed through a small instanton, and then that small instanton can be smoothed out into another smooth vector bundle, which with another structure group, and conceivably another grand unified group, and N families, which doesn't have to equal M. This process, one could imagine, being very interesting, that devastating if we were hit right now by one of these brains, all hell would break loose. Be that as it may, such a thing can occur in this theory, and I'll try to show you how and why. What its physics may be, I don't know, though I think you can think very clearly about the early universe and some very interesting implications of that sort of thing. So here's the bottom line before I launch into vector bundles. The bottom line is that M theory, by which I really only mean 11-dimensional manifestation of M theory, very naturally produces brain universe picture, where you have a 5-dimensional bulk space. The size of that bulk space is various estimates of what it may be, but it kind of settles down to around inverse 10 to the 12th or 13th GeV. So it's not Savastopoulos-sized things, unfortunately, because those are very interesting. But it's much smaller, but it isn't that small. It's considerably larger than the Grand Unified scale. So you have a, if you like, large intermediate scale bulk space. On one boundary, you have a 3-brain. That's our observable sector. It's got 3 families of quarks and leptons with the standard model gauge group. On the other side of the world, you have another 3-brain. It's the hidden sector. You can do whatever you like here, but I'll choose it for the rest of this talk to have a trivial bundle and hence an E8 hidden sector, because that way I could spontaneously break supersymmetry by Gaugino condensates, for example. And then inside the bulk, you have all these wrapped 5-brains, which could have some very interesting properties of their own. So that's the tour through heterotic M theory. And now let me get back to these 2 fundamental issues, which is to show that, yes, indeed, there exists elliptically fibered spaces with vector bundles, holomorphic vector bundles over them, that have a Z2 homotopy and hence break you to the standard gauge group. This is work done with Waldron, but also 2 Penn mathematicians, Ron Donaghy and Tony Pantev. And I warn the weak of heart. I will try to make this as painless as I can, but it is a limit. But I suffer more than the rest of you, so speak. But again, I would like to emphasize, sometimes when you do physics, you get into what seems like new, strange mathematics, and then becomes familiar to you, and it makes some sense. I think there's a good argument that these kinds of mathematics make some sense in physics, and maybe you should learn a little. Maybe I should learn a little. So I want to start out with an elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau space X, and I'll assume it has no homotopy group. Most of them don't. And I'm going to, however, consider a very special such space. First of all, in elliptic fibration, there is a base space, and then a fiber over it. Each of those fibers is a torus, speaking very loosely here and schematically. For it to be a Calabi-Yau, this base is very restricted, and that's one of the nice and physical things about it. The base could only be what's called a Del Pezzo surface, a Herzebruch surface, certain blow-ups of those Herzebruch surfaces, and also an Enriquez surface, but we know that doesn't have 3 families, so I'm just not going to consider it. So it's a simple enough structure. So over this base, then, you have this Calabi-Yau, and I'm going to assume it has 2 global sections. One of them is the thing that marks the zero and turns it into each torus into an elliptic fiber. This is a standard thing. We're going to assume there's a second section as well, which certainly can be done. And we are going to make certain other simple assumptions that if I add C to itself, I come back to this origin point P. So if you like, you add this section to itself, you come back to the other section. And that allows us to define a nice translation along the fiber. Pick any point X on the fiber and add to it this point C from the second section, and that just translates you across the fiber. Clearly, that's an involution on the space. Its square is the identity. And that's important. We want to mod this out to get the Z2, so that's where I'm heading here. This transformation just exchanges C with P and P with C. No big deal. That's the first involution. The second one is to look down on this base itself and to ask for involution, possible involution on these bases. They're restricted things, so you can't do anything you want. But we want to consider involutions on the base, so T squared is the identity. They don't have to be smooth on the base. The final involution on the Calabi-Yau should be smooth so that when we mod it out, we get a manifold. But we actually don't care what happens to the base. So, in fact, this thing can have 6 points. And I'll call the set of those 6 points script F. It's just the set of the 6 points on the base. You can then lift this up into the Calabi-Yau space in a unique way if you demand that you do not, that you leave the zero section and this new section invariant. And we'll call that lift alpha. So it's if you like, it's just the same involution, just brought up horizontally into the Calabi-Yau space. And then it's clear what you do. You composite it, alpha, with this translation, TC, and what you then get is an involution, which I'll call tau of x, on the full Calabi-Yau space, which has the property that it exchanges the zero section to this new section xi and takes xi and brings it back to the zero section. So it's a very simple involution. And the question is, does this T of x, so composed, act freely or not? And the answer is, you can show that it acts freely if and only if the following things are true. First of all, the set of fixed points should be a discrete set. And second of all, that set of fixed points should not intersect the discriminant locus. What's the discriminant locus? Here's the Calabi-Yau up here, and it's got this base. There's a very well-defined curve in that base called the discriminant curve. It's very physical. What it means is that for any fiber over a point on the discriminant curve, that torus becomes singular. If you're away from that discriminant curve, it's a smooth torus. So there's a discriminant curve, and given a theory, you can compute that. You know how to find it and how to compute it. So it should not intersect those fixed points. If that's the case, then this involution is freely acting, and you can mod it out and get a manifold. And that's just what we're going to do. We're going to take the original elliptic fibration x and divide it by this involution tau, and we're going to get a manifold, a smooth manifold. The base, it's going to be torus fibered again over a base, but that base is not smooth because it had fixed points, because tau b had fixed points. But it doesn't matter. What is interesting is that this torus vibration is not an elliptic vibration. It has no sections, so there's no zeros marked on any of these curves. So it's just a vibration of tori over the particular base. But that's okay. It's a Calabi-Yau space. It's a well-understood one but by its construction, and that's the kind of thing we're going to work with. What it does have is a hole in it. It's got a Z2 hole, and that will allow us, if we can build bundles over it, to reduce to the standard gauge group. So there's a lot of stuff here, and just walk through it. You have to, we really want to construct the bundle on this now, and constructing a bundle means something, as taught to us by Freeman, Morgan, and Witten, that you can really build these things from first principle, and what you need to know is a couple of things. I'll just list them. You need to know the independent classes of curves on this space. And they're simply, you take all the curves in the base and lift them back up into X or Z, either way. You also have the fiber, which is F, class F. But you have to do something else here. In order to get two sections, it turns out that the Weierstrass model of this theory is singular, and you have to so-called blow up some points. So you have some additional class due to blowing up of the theory to make it smooth. Doesn't matter. It's still, these are the independent curves in this new theory, in this Calabi-Yau space with two sections. Once you do that, you can, by a slight extension of the Freeman, Morgan, Witten work, you can compute the second Chern class of that particular space. And that's a non-trivial thing, and you can do it, and it depends on various data in the theory. Well, the C1 and C2 are the Chern classes in the base, which are known. So you just look them up, and you plug them in, and you can compute these Chern classes. We want to construct vector bundles really over Z, but what we're going to do is construct them over X, and then we're going to pick only those that are stable under the involution, and those will descend to Z. And I will just list the results. Bundles are associated with two things, a so-called spectral cover and a line bundle on that spectral cover. The spectral cover is obtained really by specifying a curve in the base. The line bundle is specified by, in this case, two real numbers, lambda and kappa. when n is odd, and that's what we'll do in this theory, in this talk, we'll take SU5, so little n will be odd. Kappa, lambda and kappa are simply numbers that are restricted like that. Once you know that, you can compute the second Chern class of that bundle, and you get a formula which has some extra pieces in it due to the fact you're dealing with a theory with two sections. You can also compute the third Chern class. As ugly as this stuff is, it's really simple. You give a curve in the base, you give a couple of numbers, and you've then constructed the Chern classes for the theory. And that's an important fact because you can really build these vacua. They really exist. We're not just talking here. It's really very nice. So we must restrict the bundle so that it descends to Z. And actually, this is a long story, and I'm sure not going to give it here. But when the dust settles, it is still so that what must happen is that this curve that you choose must, in fact, be invariant under the involution on the base, which is a simple enough thing to satisfy. So we return to the anomaly cancellation condition, which I stated earlier. This is the fundamental thing we must satisfy in any of these vacua. I'm picking a trivial bundle on the hidden sector wall, so that goes away. And this actually just acts as a definition for the five-brain class W. If I plug in what I just showed you for C2 and C2, then I'm going to get a formula for W, which turns out to break into three pieces. There is a base piece. That's the part that has to do with the horizontal piece. It's given by this. There is a integer A of F, which is given by all this stuff, but believe it or not, that will be an integer. And there's an integer A of N, which is given by this stuff. And that will be the five-brain class. It's important to note here that what we're doing is we're saying what the non-perturbative behavior in the bulk is not at your will. It comes about by the solution of the anomaly equations, and it's something you can learn a great deal about. When you know this curve, that actually gives you the complete data for the holomorphic curve on which it's wrapped, gives you the moduli space and a lot of other stuff. So this is an important thing, the fact that you solve for W. We're also going to, we look at the third Chern class. That tells us the number of generations is given by this formula. So here's the rules we're going to use, and I'll give you a for instance in a second. It won't be so abstract. We're going to take n odd. We'll take SU5 in a minute. We have these two numbers we have to specify, lambda and kappa, and they just have to satisfy this. Whatever it is we use for eta, the curve and the base, it simply has to be invariant under the involution on the base. This curve W that we get here, and this is an important restriction, when we compute it, has to be a special kind of homology class called an effective class. This is simply saying that this is real physics. These things exist in the real world and have to correspond to actual curves. And in the algebraic language, this tells you that W must be effective, an element of the Mori cone of the homology class, associated homology class. This will be effective if the base piece is effective and if each of those coefficients turns out to be non-negative. So the example I'll give you, we'll check this and we'll see that that's so. This is a tremendous constraint on the allowed vacua. You should not think that you can do anything you want here. It took Yao a year or so to construct the first three-family model in the old days, and here it might take a couple of days to figure out the first one of these. It's much easier. The old constraint that the second Chern class of the bundle had equal the second Chern class of the Calabi-Yau has now gone away. It's been replaced by W being effective, which is a milder condition, which is what I recommend to you because in a certain sense that helps phenomenology tremendously. Okay. And the last thing, of course, is that I want the number of generations on Z to be 3, so we'll take it on X to be 6. So here's an example. Here's how this stuff goes. Let's choose the structure group to be SU5 for simplicity. Then the commutant is SU5, so we're dealing with a grand unified theory with an SU5. Since n is odd, this has to be true. We'll just simply choose lambda to be -1/2. And we can get two solutions that will take kappa to be 0 or 1. Either of them will work. I'm allowed to build the Calabi-Yau the way I like, and I have a restriction on the base. I'll pick the base to be a Del Pezzo 3 surface. Del Pezzo 3 surface is simply a complex projective 2 space which is blown up at 3 special points. So the coordinates on this space then are just x, y, and z. I'll use that in a minute. Of course, it's projective coordinates. You want to look at the curves here. You want to look at the second homology class on the base because you want to get this curve eta. And you ask what that is. Well, it turns out that there is a basis. It's a vector space, and there is a basis of that vector space. And you can pick that basis to be composed of actually effective classes themselves. They're called L, which descends somehow from the complex projective space. And there's EI. There are exceptional divisors that are associated with each blow-up. But it doesn't matter. They're just curves, and they span the homology class. 10 minutes, great. Thanks. The Chern classes, as I said, are known. Here they are. There are other effective classes here. Let me just list them that cannot be obtained from the ones I just showed you with positive coefficients. So you actually have to know what these are. And now let's define our involution. We'll just let x, y, and z go to inverse x, inverse y, and inverse z. Remembering that this is a projective space, this clearly has 4 discrete fixed points. We can compute the discriminant curve, and we can show that generically, not always, but generically, it's very easy to pick it so it does not intersect that class, so that rule is satisfied. So in fact, the involution will now be freely acting. If we look at a certain set of these effective classes, I'll call A1, A2, and A3, those things are effective, but above all, they're invariant under tau. You just have to play around, and you can show that each of those are invariant under tau. So it's now easy to build eta to be invariant under tau of b, as it must be, by simply taking a linear combination of those. And in fact, the right answer is this, or one of the right answers is this. So with 15-15 hindsight, I can tell you pick that. So this thing is invariant, eta is effective. Take all of this and insert it into that formula for w that we had up above. And you will find that here's W of B, and it's given by this combination. But each of these A's is effective, and the sum is positive numbers. That tells us WB is also effective, so that part is okay. If we take lambda to be -1/2 and the first choice, kappa equals 0, we find that each of those integers is indeed non-negative, so that's okay. And if we take the other choice with kappa equals 1, we find that each of those integers is non-negative, so that's okay. In other words, W is indeed an effective curve, and if you take all this and plug it into the formula, you find that NG is 6, which tells you you have 3 families over Z, just the way you want. So the conclusion is that we have at least two non-perturbative vacua that have 3 families. They have a grand unified group SU5. And each one of them has a specific 5-brain class from which you can learn a great deal about the non-perturbative structure of the theory, though I don't have time to discuss that here. However, we're stuck with SU5, but not for long, because this manifold has a non-trivial homotopy group of Z2, and therefore we wrap a Wilson line around it, that generator. And we spontaneously break the theory down to SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. So that issue of being able to get really a 3-family model with a standard gauge group on the observable brain is now understood rather well, I think. I don't have much time. I'm just going to quickly flash some of this, assuming it's actually all in one piece, which is to quickly go to this question of small instanton transitions. Note that the things I just showed you had brains living in the bulk. You might ask what happens if you push them against one of the walls. This will lead to small instanton transitions, and this is work that I did with Tony Pantev and JMO Park. Very quickly, since I don't have the time here, I apologize. What you do is you start off with a bundle of the type that Freeman, Morgan, and Witten introduced, which is a smooth vector bundle of rank n, and it's with an irreducible spectral cover. You saw this before. This is the general structure. And it has some line bundle over that. That's a generic type. And you can compute the churn classes there, and that's what they are. From that, in the anomaly condition, you can write a formula for W. That's the base part, and that is A of F. And what we'd like to ask is whether there's a solution within this class of bundles where there are no five brains living in the bulk at all. That is, if you can set W equal to zero. And what we find is that, I don't want to say that it's impossible, but within any attempt we've ever made, we cannot find such a solution. So certainly any theory that we know of now that has three families and so on simply always has non-vanishing W. So the claim is there's no solution, or if there are solutions, they're so obscure that it doesn't matter, which means that if you use this kind of smooth bundle here, you're going to get a non-vanishing five-brain class wrapped on holomorphic curve. Well, if class is the holomorphic curve, living in the bulk. So let's say we have some grand unified group H and M families there. We now want to take this and push it to the boundary and then smooth it out on the other end. But how are we going to smooth it out on the other end? Because if we smooth it out on the other end, W will be zero. We have to find some kind of bundles, smooth bundles, that allow W to be non-zero. And the answer is that you can do that. It is somewhat outside the range that Freeman, Worgan, Witten discussed, at least in their physicist paper. I understand that in their mathematics paper they may have discussed this. However, these things were discussed definitely by Bershadsky and I forget the names, God, Pantev, Sadov, and Johansson. What happens is you have to look at a wider class of smooth bundles. They're of this sort. I don't have time to discuss them here. This is of the Freeman, Worgan, Witten type. M is a bundle that you put on the base and then lift back up into the Calabi-Yau space, and you compose them with a direct sum. What's important is that since this bundle lives on the base, its second churn class is just a number. And this number K is going to solve the problem for us. So by having such an extended bundle, we find that you can indeed solve the problem because of that instanton number K. The bottom line of all of this is that for this new bundle, you can compute the churn classes. They're the same as above. It's just the composition of the two. However, you have this new piece coming from M, which is just K times the fiber class F. If you now repeat the analysis for W, set W to be zero, you now discover that you can easily get a solution because precisely this number K can be chosen in such a way as to balance against all the data that's coming from the base. So there's a nice smooth bundle, no worse than the ones we started with, that indeed does allow you to have a theory with, let's say, three families and nice gauge groups, but with no five brains living in the bulk. So the picture of that is simply another smooth bundle. It's a different one. Call it V prime, and it's got some possibly different gauge group H prime and some possibly different numbers of families. I'll say N families. So we're on one side where we have a theory with five brains. We're on the other side of the transition, a theory with no five brains, and we have to pass through the middle. And that's where the hard mathematics, at least for me, occurs. And I won't even begin to try to describe that here. You have to ask JMO if you want the details, because he understands it better than I. What happens is that these things get connected as they pass through each other by a singular object, with not a smooth vector bundle. You have to pass through what's called a torsion-free sheaf, which is a degeneration of the bundle. And one can show explicitly that you can start off with one bundle, move through this singular torsion-free sheaf, that's the small instanton, and then deform that to a smooth vector bundle on the other side. So I've shown you this, that's when you had the five brains. I've shown you this, that's when you've absorbed the five brains. And this is the small instanton transition. If you really want to do this right, you should show that such transitions are really allowed. And I think at this point we've convinced ourselves and hopefully others that it is allowed, and you can see how it works. So the result here is that when these two just touch, you get a singularity, this torsion-free sheaf describing the situation. And I'll conclude the talk with just remarks that isn't physically irrelevant, because at least in the examples we've done so far, we find that the number of families you begin with and the number of families you end up with is not the same. So you definitely have chirality changing transitions here. Katru and Silverstein, maybe 3 years ago, discussed these within the context of monad bundles, and they asked whether this would be possible in elliptic vibrations, and the answer is it is possible. Further, you can change the gauge group as well. In fact, in the examples we have, it does change. So you end up with very interesting phase transitions in which you get family change and also gauge group change. What exactly the physics of that might be, I don't know. We have ideas in the early universe of how this can happen, which are very exciting. I'm working with Steinhardt and Turok on these things. We'll see what happens. But I think it is true that one can get very, it is a fundamental brain picture of the universe. It comes down to you from real string and M theory in a very compact way. You can compute just about everything you need to do from first principles, and it seems to get awfully close to the world that we know. It also has all this new non-perturbative behavior to explore. I hope somebody explores it. Thanks. No, I haven't tried. There was a paper by Bjorn Andreas at some point where I think that was attempted or done, but I don't know how to do that. Yes. It probably has more than that. You certainly have a whole bunch of U1s as hidden sector field. These are somehow hidden sectors. They'll communicate only gravitationally. But yeah, there'll be all of this stuff. But there may be much more. One thing that we've been looking at recently is what happens when you move in moduli space and approach the discriminant curve. This is just a two-dimensional example of Seiberg-Witten theory. You have a discriminant curve, and if you've wrapped a five brain on it, as you approach that curve, you're going to have all kinds of singular behavior. And that will certainly give you non-trivial conformal field theories occurring on those brains that go way beyond the U1 vector multiplets. And we've been trying to understand that to see what that might be. These things could be dark matter in the universe. Who knows what they are? Yes? Almost, yes. They were working these monad spaces, but there's no reason one has to use elliptic vibrations. They didn't have five brain classes. They always were solving C2 of the tangent bundle should equal C2 of the vector bundle, which is certainly absolutely allowed. What we've done here is to extend this to a wider class by allowing non-trivial five brains. But we're actually writing a paper right now where we're doing just what you're suggesting and widening their solutions tremendously by allowing non-trivial five-brain behavior. But you certainly can do it, yes. Yes, Michael. Yeah. Well, I've heard so much conventional wisdom that I almost hate to comment. The initial results go from, you know, a factor of 4 or 5 or 6, bigger than 10 to the 16th, whatever that was, all the way up to 10 to the 11th or so. And if I recall in your talk in Susie a year ago, you were talking about 10 to the 13th or so GeV, if I remember. So I'm just throwing out a number there. I haven't used it in any way. I'm just, I hear a wide range of numbers. And I haven't, and I think it's a little premature. You have to actually get the theory in order so you can actually compute something properly before you plug in the numbers to see how big that should be. I'm sorry. Yeah. There's potential for the zero mode. This is this gauge supergravity, which is a very interesting beast if you haven't looked at them before. you get a term, first of all, it looks absolutely non-supersymmetric because you have a term that depends only on one scalar field and none of its superpartners. So how could it even be supersymmetric? But if you look at the supersymmetry transformations, you see that they also grow an extra piece that depends only on that term. And when you work it all out, it's supersymmetric. So yes, indeed, you can get supersymmetry non-looking objects, even though they are supersymmetric, such as a potential for a component scalar that appear that are consistent with supersymmetry. That's exactly what you get. However, when you solve for the vacuum space state of this theory, what you find is that it is precisely that potential that supports the BPS3 brain. If you then dimensionally reduce onto the BPS3 brain to get the four-dimensional n equals 1 effective theory, those potentials cancel bulk against boundary. So it doesn't violate any of your notions of moduli. Yeah.
Break. Oh, good.